Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. All right, here's where we're headed this morning. Student loans have been in the news a lot lately. We're going to open the show talking about a specific college grant and loan program here in Vermont. We're going to focus on career and technical education. Then we're going to open up the phones until 10. We'll come back and, oh yeah, we've got national correspondent Bob Ney. Next, Courtney Lambden of 7 Days joins us to talk about the replacement of the Winooski River Bridge, and we'll finish the morning in Cabot at the Molly Brook Farm. But first, let's discuss a program aimed at CTE programs, or career and technical education. Joining me to enlighten us about grants and loans available for students in this field is Tom Cheney, the Executive Director of Advance Vermont. Tom, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Listeners, to ask our guest about this program, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Tom, let's make sure everybody knows the basics. Please explain what Advance Vermont is.
Sure. Yeah, Advance Vermont's a small nonprofit, and we're really focused on helping Vermonters get more education and training after high school. So we believe that education is absolutely key to having strong communities, a vibrant economy, and perhaps most importantly, financially secure families. Our work is centered around the goal that 70% of Vermonters should have a credential by 2025. So a credential means a degree, a certificate, a certification, a licensure, an apprenticeship, some sort of piece of paper that demonstrates that you've completed education and training that is viable in the career marketplace. So we really try to do 4 main things. So we try to send the message to Vermonters and to leaders that there are education and training pathways available for each and every Vermonter. A big way we do this is through myfuturevt.org, which is our one-stop shop for current education resources. We inform policy and program design by showcasing the need for education and training and many possible solutions. We bring folks together in education, business, government, nonprofit, and philanthropy to compare notes and to coordinate together to increase post-secondary attainment in the state. And we share data and do a fair amount of research in-house.
And Tom, this is a partnership, right? A really interesting partnership. Just briefly, you know, who's involved in Advance Vermont and forwarding this mission?
Yeah, so we were founded in 2017 by the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation, so VSAC, the Vermont State College System, UVM. Other folks kind of in that landscape were involved, and it was after a conversation that was had between leaders in education, nonprofit, government, philanthropy, and all said, what is the right level of attainment in the state? What level of education should we have in Vermont, and how are we going to get there? And so Advance Vermont was stood up to help coordinate those efforts, and our partners range from the Department of Labor, Higher Ability Vermont, formerly known as Voc Rehab, to we work with Chambers of Commerce and many other players across the state to increase attainment in the state.
The governor, Governor Phil Scott, focused on CTE or career and technical education this week, and that's what we're going to discuss. So what exactly, when I'm using that term, tell me what exactly I'm talking about, career and technical education, CTE.
Yeah, so career and technical education is a really, really vital pathway for Vermonters to get a leg up in their education and training. So there are two main ways to kind of talk about CTE. So there are high school programs, and I think that's probably what Vermonters think about when they think about CTE or technical education, some in way, way past. Folks might have called it VoTech,
right,
or that kind of thing. So that is when you are typically a high school junior or senior. You can go and take your course of studies. Sometimes it's a full day, sometimes it's part day, at a regional technical center. There are about 17 across the state, and they are sometimes offered, you know, within a district, or sometimes they're actually kind of their own district. But what students will get when they walk into those doors is you know, their education that they would expect, kind of their typical education they would expect at a high school. They're either getting at their high school or at this center, but they're also getting they're in one immersive program where they're gaining a very specific skill set, whether it's in graphic design, culinary arts, HVAC, all sorts of different things, and they're focused in learning that trade, learning that skill, and often learning and earning credentials that have value in the marketplace as soon as they graduate and complete their program. Many of them are actually earning college credits while they're taking those courses, and many more continue on to education and training after high school.
Well,
that's the high school program.
Right.
And then there's an adult program. And that's, you know, often nights and weekend programs where they're maybe more finite. There's often a specific certification that someone is going for or training that they're going for. And those run the gambit as well in terms of the different programs that are offered.
And let's talk about those, you know, post-high school classes, degrees, training. What's available? Where are they offered in the state?
Yeah, so they're offered all across the state. Every single high school has a partnership with one or more technical centers where they can actually send their students there during the school day. So they are, you know, all spread out regionally across the state. They're agreements there to make sure that students have access to those.
And Tom, specifically now post high school, are there, you know, is it VTC? Where are these CTE programs?
Yeah, so the CTE programs are embedded right in those same centers.
Oh, gotcha.
So if you're an adult looking for a program, you're not a high school student, they're right there too. And there are so many different programs available for you, from, like I said earlier, culinary arts to graphic design and all of the above. And there are partnerships, I think, as well, you know, emerging with colleges as well, to make sure that we're driving pathways from you know, this original credential or this first credential onto a second or third or fourth.
Why is this such a focus right now in Vermont, Tom?
Well, there's a huge need. I don't think we have to, any of us have to drive very far to see we want help signs, the help wanted signs across the state. We have some major challenges with our workforce. A great report came out from the Public Assets Institute just, I think, this week or last. And basically it said, you know, the good news is that the jobs lost during the pandemic have been added back. So in other words, employers that reduced the number of jobs that they had have now added them back and then some. But the bad news is they just can't find workers for many of these positions. There are three jobs available for each person looking for work in the state. And the workforce is still down. So that hasn't recovered. I think the number is about 18,000 Vermonters are still out of the workforce compared to pandemic. So that, I think, is in short kind of the landscape. There are just so many jobs available. And it's not just because of the pandemic. We knew this is coming. We have an aging workforce, and none of this is particularly new. But we have to make sure that we're educating our workforce so that they can go take these jobs, because many, many, many of these positions require skills that some Vermonters or a lot of folks don't have right now.
VSAC has announced grants, and I believe an interest-free, forgivable loan program for CTE students. What can you tell us about these?
Yeah, so it's called the Vermont Trades Scholarship Forgivable Loan Program, and this is a program that the legislature set up and VSAC is administering that covers up to full tuition, initial licensing fees, and exam fees for folks who are enrolled in industry-recognized training and certification programs. And they have to lead to a career in certain areas, so building, mechanical, industrial, medical trades, emergency services, energy, which would include the energy efficiency or weatherization, transportation, broadband. We know we need a lot more electrical installers or linemen out there, and then some other careers as well. So basically, the funding's awarded to qualifying participants kind of at a first-come, first-served basis. But what they get from this is an interest-free loan, which will cover the cost of all of this training and what's really cool, the exam fees, so they get licensed. And then when they complete this education and training, they will have promised, this participant will have promised to have completed certain work obligations. So in this case, it's they agree to work in their profession in state, in Vermont, for a minimum of a year following licensure or certification for each year of the funding that they've received.
And Tom, let's connect the dots. I did a show yesterday where we were talking about the need for, housing here in the state. We are going to see probably a good amount of new homes built, of residences being rehabbed to make them habitable. So you take one of these classes and the trades you just talked about, those jobs, I would imagine were on kind of the precipice of a massive increase in those jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a huge demand for this. So, you know, the building trades programs that are in CTE, I think have always done really well. We need to make sure that those are full, that folks are going to those and making sure that we have folks trained in the building trades. There's a huge need for that. And what's neat too is that the legislature also actually funded us a new CTE program that will actually rehab old properties. So that it gives some fund. I think it creates a revolving fund that actually will fund CTE centers and their students and their programs to actually go into the houses and rehab them. And then there'll be, you know, accessible housing for Vermonters. So it's a one way to both help make sure that we have an educated citizenry, we have skilled workers in this area, but also that there's a product on the other end for folks to actually move into.
I hate to
but
use
there's a huge need. You're totally right.
Yeah, I hate to use the term, but it does sound win-win right now. Tom, during the pandemic, many people took that step back, right, and looked at their careers, really got a fresh perspective about what they want to do. Have we seen a rise in people going into the CTE fields?
Yeah, we have. I mean, it's hard to measure right now whether we've seen folks increase and kind of get into those particular fields, but we have seen increased enrollment by high school students in CTE. So from just before the pandemic to now, we've gone from about 25% of high school juniors and seniors are enrolled in CTE to now about 32-33%.
Wow.
So we have certainly seen an interest increase in the past few years. And I'd like to think that that has to do with the changing of the conversation that has been had in the state over the last few years.
Oh, Tom, that's a substantial increase. And I'm glad you brought that up. What are students looking for in these education programs?
Yeah, so students are looking increasingly towards a career connection. So you look at almost any kind of research that's being done right now, and career seekers and education seekers of any age are looking for that connection to their work. So increasingly, they're looking for that often translates into short-term credentials that are very skill-focused, that have transferability and stackability. So what that means is that they can be used in one job and at another similar job, that they can be stacked. So you could take a few of them, and that kind of creates a really nice package of credentials. Hmm. They're really looking for those types of opportunities that also have a really strong perceived return on investment.
Let's head to East Corinth. We've got Forbes on the line. Hi, Forbes. Go right ahead.
Oh, hey. Good morning. Speaking to the positive ends of vocational education, not every student is a rogue scholar or college material. And this gives a great opportunity for somebody to move into an area that they're more comfortable with. And I think guidance counselors in our school systems have really got to perk up to the fact of identifying a student who's kind of turned off against the regular educational program,
yep,
has different talents, and then redirect that person towards vocation.
Forbes, this is
I
a brilliant...
Myself,
yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. I can leave it at that.
No, don't leave it at that. I want to hear your own story. Go ahead.
Well, I'm a product of vocational education. I graduated from high school took a college entrance exam, passed that, and said, wait a minute, I'm mechanically inclined.
Yep.
I don't want to go to that. So I took a two-year special GI program, and that 2 years in vocational school equaled 8 years out in the field trying to pick it up on my own.
Excellent.
So it's a great opportunity for people that are headed in that direction.
Forbes, thank you so much for sharing that. What a great point he's making, Tom. And, you know, there are those of us who are book smart. That was my bailiwick. But then you look at someone who can create that tongue and groove, you know, joint, right? And you think, what in the world, when they're building, you're doing woodwork, or my father could install an oil burner and a plumbing system. I would help him haul out the old oil burners and maybe clean a fitting. But that is a skill and a mindset, a clarity that I might get from reading a book that they get from doing hands-on work.
Well, right on. I think the message we try to send Vermonters is that there is a path for you. It might be college. It might be CTE. It might be another type of education training. Maybe it's an apprenticeship. But there is a path that works for everybody. And what we need to do is help, I think to Forbes's point, tease that out. And so there's a lot of different ways we're trying to do that right now. So with myfuturevt.org, you know, Advanced Vermont's one-stop shop for career and education resources, that's our message, right?
Yep.
It's that there's a path for you, and let's help you figure out what that path is. There is good money in these trades. There is a really good work-life balance that you can find in some of these careers. Whatever you're looking for, you can find that in these different pathways. And I think the point that Forbes was making is a good one, is that school counselors are really important here. But it's not just the school counselors. It's the teachers.
Mm.
And it's the other folks who are influencers in their life. It might be a coach, or it might be an employer. And what we have to do is that we are equipping, make sure we are equipping them, those we call them navigators, so that they can help direct folks towards whatever they might seem like, you know, is their interest or a really good skill set.
Yeah. I have a couple of friends who are plumbers. Talk to them. One had to take his listing out of the yellow pages at one point,
mm-hmm.
Because he just had too much work. They are never lost for work. The economy goes up or down. Trust me, a lot of these trades will stay consistent. Let's try to get another call in. We'll head to Newbury. Fred's on the line. Hi, Fred.
Oh, yeah. This is very interesting because
you're
talking about people that are trainable. So what happens to the people that aren't trainable? The Army in particular, they give you a test, and the test is to find out if you're trainable. And if you're not trainable, you can't get in the Army. So if you have if your paragraph comprehension is next to zero, and your elementary mathematics is almost equal, then basically you're not trainable. So we have thousands of people out there that aren't trainable. What's going to happen to them?
Well, I think, Fred, to your point, this is exactly what we're talking about. And I'm not saying that everybody who goes into a trade is not tradable, is not great at math, is not book smart. As a matter of fact, my father was a machinist and brilliant at math, had to use a lot of math in that job. There are a lot of skills that are, needed in these trades, but this is an excellent opportunity. Let's talk again, Tom, about financial support that is available for non-college programs.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a lot of resources, and they've been increased throughout the last few years. So VSAC administers a lot of these programs. One is called the Advancement Grant. And so the Advancement Grant has been around for a long time. It did used to have a different name. And this grant program is available for folks who are pursuing non-degree pathways. And it provides them quite a bit of funding to cover their non-degree course or their short-term training program. And so that's a really great place to start. There's this program that we talked about, that we've been talking about with the trades program. There's early childhood education for a Give a Will Loan program. Mm. There's nursing programs as well for LPNs and some of the ones that don't necessarily require a degree and those that do as well. So there's a host of state-funded programs that do this. There's also the Curtis Fund, and the Curtis Fund is philanthropic organization, and they provide scholarships to Vermonters, both for degrees and for non-degrees. And they have a Credential of Value program that is offering really generous support to Vermonters to help them make sure that they can access these really important careers.
Oh, that's a great point. I'm glad you brought up the Curtis Fund, another one. Tom, again, tell people where they can go. If they're interested, they know someone who might be interested, it's really important to follow up right now.
Yeah, so I would send folks to myfuturevt.org/free-money. myfuturevt.org/free-money, and that'll give you an overview of all of the new aid for the 22-23 school year, both for non-degree options as well as the degree options. There are millions and millions of dollars available from you know, non-degree programs to two-year programs at CCV, or some incredible ones there, to four-year programs. Also, assistance for folks who are actually trying to enroll in early college that might go through a CTE program as well. There's great funds there through the McClure Foundation. So go start there. And then make sure you also head over to the VSAC website, where they'll have many more additional, much more additional information and resources.
All right. Tom Chaney, Executive Director of Advance Vermont. Again, myfuturevt.org/free-money. Tom, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
All right. We're going to take a break, then return with super exciting and mildly dangerous open phones. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
I'm in the phone booth, it's the one across the hall. If you don't answer, I'll just bring it on the wall.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Ah, the new house band, Bill the Buff and the Bold Vikings. Yeah, covering another Blondie tune for our open phone music. This is Hanging on the Telephone. And there's Clem Burke again on the drums. Hear him? Yeah, all right. Okay, that does signal that phones are open, 802-244-1777, 877-291-TALK. You can email, that's open too, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Okay, so... Yeah, I have an email that came in yesterday for yesterday's show that I want to read, which talks about form-based code from Bill. Bill, thanks for writing that. We'll get to that. But I also want to talk about toys. You know, the crazy dangerous ones that toy companies put out in the 60s and 70s that we played with and somehow avoided severe cranial damage or loss of limb. I mentioned jarts or lawn darts. To a friend the other day, and he came back with he mentioned Mattel's Real Power Shop, and I guess this kind of goes with the discussion we just had last half hour. But here's how what he wrote to me. He said, "For Christmas one year, I got a Mattel electric jigsaw. No, not battery operated. You plugged it in the wall. It was a working jigsaw with several pieces of wood about the size of index cards. You were supposed to be able to cut one piece, cut out pieces of wood from templates and then glue them to build little toys with it." He says, "I was eight." He was eight when he got this jigsaw. It scared the pee out of me. I'm not sure he ever used it. But I want to know, what edgy toys or games were you presented with in your youth? Oh, I've got a few. Our wee Danny here is going to get an education this morning on the dangerous toys that we grew up with in the 60s and 70s. 802-244-1777, 877-291-TALK. And so yesterday we focused the show. I was at the Madsonian Museum in Waitsfield for the show, and we were focusing on, building homes, on transportation and on design and planning of our communities. And Bill wrote a great email. I didn't get to it yesterday. I apologize. Sometimes when I am at a remote broadcast, it's a little more difficult to work in phone calls. It's a little more difficult to check my email. So, Bill, I apologize. But here's what Bill wrote. The town of Williston is in the process of adopting form-based code for the Taft's Corner area. This is a new look at zoning that effectively gets rid of the old notion of zoning districts and encourages mixed-use neighborhoods where commercial and residential uses are integrated along with public green space. The idea is to encourage more pedestrian villages, much like was present in the past with less vehicle traffic. The one thing I have noticed while this process has been evolving is the notion of change. Change typically happens generationally and not in quick progressive steps, much like the 80s when country living evolved as a preferred choice over time. In Williston, it appears that with the new notion of building up rather than building out, many residents and developers have not embraced the idea, even though in areas around the country where form-based codes have been enacted show far superior economic, social, and demographic benefits than other areas that kept traditional zoning. Great point, Bill. Form-based code definitely being enacted in Newport and in Winooski. And I will point, Bill, to this, if you'd like to go back and listen to the podcast, on June 9th, I did have Eric Vorwald on. Eric is the planning and zoning manager of the city of Winooski. And when you drive into Winooski, you're seeing a lot of now the fruits of form-based code. And we had a great discussion about how Winooski is going about it. And so if you go to our June 9th podcast, Eric Vorwald, the planning and zoning manager for the city of Winooski, you'll get a good, really good discussion on that. All right, let's get to the phones. We're going to start in Eden with Brian. Hi, Brian. How you doing?
All right. I love the discussion on toys.
Yeah. Okay, good.
I grew up in the 70s, so.
And you're still alive. You're still alive and breathing.
Yeah, exactly. We used to play Dodge Jart, for one thing, which was crazy when the parents weren't around. But the other
and you got to hope that there's like no Patrick Mahomes in your neighborhood. You know that there's nobody who can just throw a pee accurately at one of your friends or,
We had a couple minor wounds, but nothing too serious.
All right, good.
But the big one was, I guess that was a scientific bent of mine when I was 7 or 8. So they used to buy me these, you know, at Christmas, I'd get like this set and I would get like little creatures in jars full of formaldehyde, you know, basically. And then the good old chemistry set.
Right.
If you had that stuff that I had when I was, you know, 7 or 8, it's just like, oh, of course you get a chemistry set with a kid because he likes science.
Right.
I mean, you would be on a Homeland Security list if you did it now. The same stuff is just nuts. So
I forgot about the chemistry set. Oh, my gosh. You could mix up all kinds of stuff with that, you know, and it just seemed harmless back then, right? It's like, oh, okay, you know, give the kid a chemistry set. They seem to have an inclination towards science. This will advance them, you know. And, yeah. Brian, like, we would be kind of left to our own devices with this stuff, right?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, go play with your chemistry set. You know, I bought it for you. You know, go do something.
Yeah, it's the occasional tragedy, but usually everybody seems to have gotten through alive at least. So.
Yeah. So do you remember this one, Brian? Do you remember creepy crawlers?
Creepy crawlers.
So you got they were probably lead. You had these these little molds, right? And you poured goop into them, right?
And there was that little – that thing was dangerous. You plugged it in to heat everything up.
That thing, yeah. So you'd pour this into the, you know, this goop. You could make them multicolor or whatever you want. It was this goop. You'd pour it into these molds, these lead molds, and then you would take the lead mold. You get the little pair of tongs, and you'd put it on basically a –
blazing hot plate, a hot plate, right? You'd plug that into the wall, and then they gave you these little plastic trays you'd fill with water. And you, right? So, I don't know, you would be poking at it to see if it's now formed solid, right? That all that plastic goop has, now cooked. And then you'd pull this thing out, and again, it's blazing hot, right? It could have been second-degree burns. I laugh now. You'd put it in the water, the steam would rise, and you couldn't wait to pull the critter out and see what you created. Yeah, creepy crawlers.
Yeah, there were all kinds of. There's also the whole world of model rocketry.
Oh, right.
We had these gas-powered airplanes. They were like drones, back
right.
in the day. Just really, really sketchy.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my God. We survived it all, riding in the open back of a pickup truck to go into baseball practice.
The entire baseball team in the back of
right.
the pickup truck go get ice cream and stuff.
There you go. Brian, thanks for the call. All right.
Have a good one.
All right. The chemistry set. All right. Phones are open for a very dangerous round of open phones this morning. What not safe at all toys did you have as a wee bairn? 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Holy crap. What were our parents and the toy companies thinking back in the day? Wood-burning kits, they'll be fine. Super balls, hey, they're cool. Just get your face out of the way when you bounce one in the street. Phones are open, and we are anxious to hear how edgy play got in your neighborhood. What about some of those all-metal playgrounds you hung out at? And that thing that got rotating at about 100 miles an hour and you couldn't get off of? Whoa. All right. The phones are open, and as a matter of fact, they are full right now. So we're going to try to move this along quickly. 802-244-1777, 877-291-TALK. And we first go to the Duke of Newbury, the Duke without portfolio. Your Grace, I hate to rush royalty, but we got to move it right along today.
Okay. All right. Got it. Hey, I was checking out prime numbers because I know you like prime numbers.
Yes.
And I discovered that the sum, you have to eliminate two, but the sum of two prime numbers is always even. Did you know that?
Well, because it would always be two odd numbers, and whenever you add two odd numbers, it would be even. That makes sense. I don't think I knew that, but it makes total sense, right, Fred?
And then they have what they call a twin prime number. And if I figured it out right, a twin prime number, it has to have two common factors. You have to eliminate one. So one is a common factor. If it's got two common factors, it's called a twin prime number. You can check that. But I think that's how it works.
All right. All right. Good, Fred. Fred takes us to safety with prime numbers. I like that. But now let's get dangerous with Steve in Barrie. Hi, Steve. Go right ahead.
Hi, Rick. This is a completely different subject than the one you're mentioning.
That's all right.
It's stimulated by President Biden's announcement about repayment of student loans and forgiveness of student loans. And already I've been reading remarks about people, what about me, what about those, et cetera, et cetera. I've been in higher education all my life. And there have been studies after studies over the last 50 years that have shown that all the student loan programs more than pay for themselves because of the increased tax revenue from increased salary that students earn. And it's been such a common finding that it's right up there with prime numbers as far as facts go.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, if the programs had always been grants and not loans, they still would have returned sufficient income to pay for themselves.
Oh, that is interesting, Steve. Thanks for that point. I'm a kid whose father was, a steel worker, so lower middle class, got to go to college on grants and loans, and had, I mean, the loans I came out of college with were, you know, $90 a month for, you know, maybe 6 years. Grad school, I had an assistantship that paid for most of it. And, I don't love this idea of, our kids, this generation carrying such steep and heavy loans. So, you know, let's find a way, to unburden them. Great point, Steve. I like that. I want to look into that, further. Let's move on to East Corinth. Forbes is up next. Hi, Forbes. Go right ahead.
It's me again.
Yeah, good.
Well, you got open phone lines, so
yep.
Here we go.
Good.
Expanding on this morning's program with regards to a woman and a bear.
Oh, yeah.
I have 4.5 acres of apples and 1/2 acre of blueberries, and the destruction by the bears this year is probably in excess of $5,000 anyway, mm-hmm. Tearing things apart. We've moved from, a earlier survey of 1,600 bears to now over 6,000 bears.
Right.
And the problem is that there isn't enough food source for all of them. I'd like to hear from some state official as to what they plan on dealing with this issue.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I did have one of our bear biologists on a few weeks ago, but I think Forbes, it might be worthy of revisiting that. It's this tough call, right? There is exactly what you're saying. There's a carrying capacity in the state that includes, you know, how much food is available to them and how much bear human interaction we are willing to tolerate. And that all goes into then how many hunting licenses are released each year. But Forbes, great point, and I'll try to get someone back on in the weeks ahead to talk about that. All right, on to Faiston and Cindy. Hi, Cindy. Go right ahead.
Hi. Yeah, back to the creepy crawler thing.
Sure.
I had one, and I loved that thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could warm it up and put it in the goop or whatever, and yeah, whatever color you wanted to make. And I had a lot of fun making those creepy crawlers. And then there was this other thing that I had. It's called a bongo board.
Oh.
I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
I haven't.
No? Well, it's a log, like a log with a ring around it, and then a platform, almost like a skateboard or something, and you had to balance on it, you know, put one foot on the other and the other, and you just, what you did is you kind of rolled along, and most likely it would tip over to
right.
the side, but the deal was that you would balance it, and some people were really good at it. They could actually jump up and flip around on it, and I never got that far with it,
yeah,
but I sure loved it. It was a fun thing to do.
Oh, I love it, and thanks, Cindy, for that. Yeah, some people could get their balance on it, and the rest of them had broken ankles. Let's move on to the Adirondacks. Kathleen, it's great to hear from you this morning. How are you?
Hi, Kathleen. I listen to you every day.
Thanks.
As I'm sure all your listeners do. But I, my brother had stilts. And do you remember stilts?
Oh, yeah.
Where you would, almost like a clown, you would step up on these sticks and
yeah.
walk?
Yeah.
Yeah, we had those. And so he would put me on it when I'm like 4 and I'm more than once falling. But also my brother, I guess he wasn't very nice. We had paddle balls. If you got to go to the 5 and dime store, you'd get a paddle ball mm-hmm. for $1.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're supposed to hit the ball with the paddle ball and come back up to the paddle.
Right.
But he'd just be chasing us, hitting us with the ball. we had Easy Bake Oven,
yes,
and
yes.
You could cook anything, and you could cook a meatloaf in a Easy Bake Oven.
Not a good one,
and,
though. Kathleen, not a good meatloaf.
No, not a good meatloaf. But my friends, what we would do is take the chocolate chips out of the bakery pantry at home,
yeah,
and we'd melt all the chocolate chips, and we'd just play and play and play.
Yeah.
So for me, Easy Bake Oven. But I also still have all of my Charlie Browns from childhood.
Oh,
I
wow.
am the biggest Charlie Brown collector in the world. I was born in 1960. 64, and I have all the Charlie Browns on a shelf upstairs in a room. So,
oh my gosh.
Anyway, this was fun. I love toys. I still have an Etch-A-Sketch, too, my original.
Oh, and that's a pretty safe one. All right, thanks, Kathleen. We're going to try to get – we got about a minute left. We got Bob in Hardwick. Bob, go.
Yes, hi there.
Hi.
My parents bought me a lead soldier making kit when I was 9 years old for Christmas. And for 3 winters, I smelted lead in the basement because you had to buy raw lead and melt it in the cookers and in a pan. And then you poured lead into the mold and sometimes do a splatter and burn it into your hands and arms. And, I've been diagnosed as being saturated with lead poisoning.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm laughing. Oh, Bob. So very quickly, Bob, what did the lead soldier creation, toy, what career did it lead to for you?
Not into the military. For 3 years, I smelled these darn things, and the house stank, and this is Bob Edibles, by the way. It just made such a mess of everything. Of course, I had an uncle and one of my classmates, who this place is named after, was built after, also died from lead poisoning.
Oh gosh, I'm so sorry, Bob. We got to go. We'll talk again, Bob. I promise. Oh my goodness, where's Bob? Oh, he's down in the basement smelting lead. All right, Danny. I think. We only had to airlift 15 of our listeners to the medical dispensary this morning. Maybe we'll have better luck next week. Shut them down. Thanks to everyone who played along today on open phones. We're going to take a break for CBS News. Then we'll catch up with Bob Ney. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at wdevradio.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, and now it's time to check in with national correspondent Bob Ney. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you, Rick.
You're welcome. Bob, the Mar-a-Lago affidavit, first of all, is this the most anxiously awaited affidavit in U.S. history? We're waiting till noon today to get a glimpse.
Well, I think so, because normally you don't even get to see them anyway. There's always 100 reasons the government doesn't do it. I'd like to see the one in my case. In fact, we said we'd like to see it, but we're not going to. And in this case, unprecedented case, I think this is the most awaited affidavit of what's going to be there, though, Rick.
Yeah.
If you ever want to see something that's amazing, Valerie Flame was a CIA agent that was outed by Scooter Libby years back. She wrote a book.
Yep, right.
And if you look at her book, out of like 10 pages, 8 of them are blanked out by the CIA. They redacted her book. And this will probably be in comparison. The vast majority, let me just guess it, 85% is going to be, quote, redacted, blacked out.
All right, the Bob Ney over-under is 85%.
85%, I'm going to go. 85.3.
That's how you set odds, Bob. Doing well. What might we actually be able to discern from what's left unredacted?
Well, there's probably going to be pieces of it, because what will happen is, just like if you throw blood into the water in an ocean, the sharks come, and what's going to happen in this case, the media is going to have a frenzy of a feeding frenzy, because they're going to look at every single thing, unless, the government was successful in really making nothing available hardly, which is what they wanted to do. But they're going to look at every single thing and try to piece like a puzzle back together. Let me give you kind of an example, if I could,
for
your listening audience.
Sure.
And it's a personal example. When the government was asking me for emails, they asked me also on the list, and my lawyers looked at me and said, why would the government want Andre Bocelli, any email dealing with Andre Bocelli and Cher? Andre Bocelli's an Italian singer, and we all know who Cher is.
Right.
And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, I don't know. Did they ever meet Jack Abramoff? You know, the guy in the scandal with me.
Right.
And it ended up, we pieced it together. There had been a staffer. He thought we wanted tickets, special tickets for them, which we didn't. But somebody had asked about tickets. So, you know, we pieced it together. I'm just giving you kind of a trite example, but it's true. So the media is going to be looking for anything in there and then try to go back and start calling people. Frankly, this is probably why affidavits are not released, especially during the investigation of a case. So the government's not going to be happy whatsoever with any of this.
Gotcha. And is there anything, any kind of like back and forth between former President Trump and the FBI that we'll discern from this affidavit?
Now, that's a really great question, because that's kind of the heart of the matter. And I think that's something that the media would and should dig into. At some point in time, there were discussions between the government's lawyers out of justice and the Trump lawyers. And they went back and forth. Now, somewhere is contained notes on these where, you know, did the government say, where's document 5 dealing with the National Security Agency? And Trump's lawyers are like, well, document 5 was in the box we gave you last month. I mean, there's conversations like this are actually documented, you know. They're not taped.
Right.
They don't tape, but they document. So if that's in there where it says the government asked for documents, the documents were not given, they won't identify what they are for national security purposes, then that's going to be of interest, because you can then go back to Trump lawyers as the media and say, so they did ask you for documents. Did you answer? You know, that's where they can get into a give and take with Trump's people.
All right.
Government won't say anything.
Hmm. All right, let's move on to President Biden's student loan decision, the idea of forgiving certain student loans. What's the plan? How would it be paid for, Bob?
Well, there's really no plan that I know of that pays for it. It's just kind of magically there. It'll encompass about $300 billion if it was the full $50,000 that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren had supported earlier. They've supported it for a long time. That's
right.
Why I mention it.
Yep.
Then it would have been about $980 billion. So I don't believe that there is actually a way that it pays, because part of the problem with this executive order is going to be the budgetary implications. Congress sets the budget. And if you look back at different executive orders presidents have done, you'll probably see Democrat and Republican leaders over the years saying, president has no right to do something that affects us monetarily. Policy, yes. Border policy, yes. Monetarily, no. So if this is challenged in court, then there might be a problem where Congress has to come back and basically, I'll say, codify this. So as far as I know, there's not a mechanism, you know, to pay for it, because then the president is really starting to write budgets in executive orders, which you simply can't do. I think that would be ruled illegal in 10 seconds if he comes up with the mechanism, frankly, to pay for it. The other problem is going to be with this, and of course the government's the government, you know, and the Department of Education, I guess, from what I read, only has information on 8 million of the 30 million people. And according to the article, I hope this is wrong, Rick, it may take years to figure out who's owed what money.
Oh, wow.
Years.
Mm.
Not weeks.
Yeah, I'm with you. And just to be clear, Bob, doesn't the Fed already forgive some student loans, probably many student loans?
Yes, there has been some student loan forgiveness. And I think it came out of – I don't believe it was an executive order. I think it came out of the Department of Education itself, you know?
Yeah.
And So I think it came out of that. Now, possibly it was something that was within the law, you know, that that they were allowed to do that, okay. I would assume.
Yeah. All right. Let's shift our gaze internationally to Taiwan. Senator Blackburn of Tennessee, what was it that she said that about Taiwan recently?
She dared to call it a country. I don't know what you're supposed to call it, but she called it a country, the country of Taiwan. And I don't understand why China, you know, it's a country. They may think they own it, but it is a country. And so I don't know what they really think you ought to say. Well, I'm happy to be in this place. But Senator Blackburn went over and she happened to say, you know, appreciate being in your country. And China went wild over that. Of course, she's not going to care. You know, she'll hit back at them.
Right, exactly. I guess
it won't hurt her in Tennessee with China opposing her.
That's right. She's the senator from Tennessee. How much does China place on a comment, you know, by a U.S. senator?
I think they place a lot, and they're getting more touchy about it. In 1996, I believe it was, I was in China. And I brought my own translator who was an American military person. I didn't want to use Chinese translators, you know. And I brought my own translator, and we were at a luncheon, and he said, they're talking about you at the table. And we went over, and they said to me, and I'll never forget this, it was freaky. You got to remember, this is pre-internet days, basically.
Right.
And they said, you use the word, we should be contained, and we don't like that, and we don't know why you did that. I couldn't even remember where I said it. We got back and searched, and there was a county of 10,000 people called Noble County, Ohio, and I had said it in one of their monthly journal newspapers at an event down there. That meant way back in the 90s, China clipped that from the Noble County paper, and they had that, you know? I mean, that's fascinating. Just think today with the internet. You know, and I was just a member of Congress. So way back then, they were angry if you said anything, and now it's explosive with them. If you really want to get them to blow their top, just mention the Dalai Lama,
and they
completely freak out. It's even worse than Taiwan in some cases.
Oh, my goodness. I could just imagine. All right, who's coming to visit? Get us the Bob Ney file. Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. I will never get a visa to China. Trust me. It will not happen. Not again. No.
Especially now with the internet. They can find everything you've ever done.
Well, and I did press conferences with Bernie Sanders, you know, screaming about China.
Yeah.
Unfair trade practices. So they've got a lot of clips.
Oh, Bob. Well, you're still allowed on this show.
Thank you.
We won't dig that too deep into your checkered past. National correspondent Bob Ney, always a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks so much for being on.
Thank you so much.
All right. Have a great weekend. We're going to take a break and then return to talk with Courtney Lambden of 7 Days about some serious infrastructure. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. The infrastructure bill in Congress, pretty easy one to get passed. Money flows to states. Reps and senators can point to bringing back our fair share. And we all try to avoid bridge and interstate collapses like Minneapolis experienced several years ago, right? So Courtney Lambden of 7 Days joins us to talk about a big project that will be taking place in Chittenden County, an infrastructure project. Courtney, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick, for having me.
You're welcome. Let's not sugarcoat this one, Courtney. How crappy is the Winooski River Bridge that connects Winooski and Burlington? Go for it.
I would say pretty crappy. it's really not a great experience to cross that bridge for any mode of travel. So as a lot of people know, there are two very narrow travel lanes in each direction that cars have to squeeze into. There's a high rate of sideswipe crashes there because of that. The sidewalks that are on either side of the bridge are crumbling. They're old, you know, and there's really no buffer from the traffic next to you. And meantime, cyclists don't have any real safe way of traversing the bridge. And people probably go a little faster than they should over it as well.
Yeah, probably. yeah, I have never walked or biked across it. But I will say I fear, as I'm driving it, I fear for those who are trying to do that, those brave souls. I just think, why are you can't you get across some other way? Should be like a service that takes them across the river itself. So what do you know about the history of this bridge?
Yeah, so it was built in 1928 to replace one that was destroyed in the historic flood of 1927. There was a lot of infrastructure, bridges, roads that were completely destroyed in that weather event. So this one was built the year after, and it's had a number of repairs since then. There was kind of a substantial rehabilitation of it in the mid-90s. And over time, it's continued to deteriorate. It's not falling apart, like it's not structurally unsound, but it definitely has a lot of deficiencies that could be addressed. So I think this project has been on, you know, a list to address for a long time, but there just hasn't been the funding to do that until recently.
Yeah. So what kind of financial help is on the way?
Right. So like you mentioned, the federal infrastructure bill really bolstered this program that's known as the RAISE grants. It's a very competitive program, and because of the infrastructure bill, the funding for that program doubled this year. Vermont won three different grants, and the one that we're focusing on here was awarded to V-Trans, a $24.8 million grant to replace this bridge. The cities that are involved, Burlington and Winooski, they jointly own the bridge, so they also have to chip in, as does the state. And the whole thing would cost about $31 million, they say at this point. So most of the cost is covered.
Well, that's good to hear. What sort of work is expected to be done to the Winooski River Bridge?
Yeah, so that's the big deal, right? No one wants to see that bridge close for an extended amount of time. According to V-Trans, that bridge is the state's third most heavily traveled bridge apart from any on the interstate. Hmm. So it's really the only direct link between Burlington and Winooski. You know, ambulances go across there to get to the hospital. You know, thousands of commuters. I think it's more than 25,000 cars a day. So the you know, powers that be are trying to figure out a way to design this project in a way that disrupts traffic as little as possible. So the method that they are proposing is what is known as a lateral slide, where they would keep the existing bridge open, but next to it, just upstream on the river there, they would build the new bridge and then slide it in when it's complete. And instead of being closed for, you know, several years, they say that method would only require about a 6-week closure, which would be annoying, but not quite as bad as several years.
So during those 6 weeks, Courtney, I can just see that the Winooski Oval, the Winooski Speedway, could turn into like a drag race. You know, people just spinning around that oval, right? Because they have no bridge to get to. It should be a lot of quote unquote fun. So the lateral slide is what they're looking at. Have we seen this used anywhere else in Vermont?
It's only been used two other times. There was one on a pair of interstate bridges on Interstate 91 in Hartford, and using that method allowed the crews to finish that project in just over the span of two different weekends. That one was a little different because the bridges were crossing land, not water, so the crews could work on the new bridges underneath the existing ones, so a little bit easier there. The other one was in Cavendish, which is obviously a much more rural town with a lot less traffic than this one.
Yeah. Is there a timeline for bridge replacement here?
Yeah. The money that comes from this RAISE grant does have a timeline built into it. So there's a lot of, you know, official language that they use, but essentially they have to have their plans, their budget, and everything approved by federal highway officials within 5 years of receiving that grant. So they really do have sort of, you know, in the transportation world, my understanding is that this is a pretty quick turn to do this bridge.
Hmm. I know you can't predict the history, but I am going to throw out some bridges bridge timetables that for us to ponder. And I'm going to ask, you know, is there any chance we might see what we did at the Crown Point Bridge in Addison, the Champlain Bridge in Montpelier, where inspectors came in and all of a sudden shut them down a few years earlier than expected, and the timetable had to be moved forward at a rapid pace?
Yeah, I think that's everyone's concern, and that was a point that was raised in the application for this grant money, which is, you know, if the bridge continues to deteriorate, they might just have, it might have to be closed down. But at this point, the most recent inspection of that bridge, which was in May 2021, said that it's in fair condition, meaning that it's not, you know, there's no risk of imminent collapse. Of course, you know, like we've talked about, it's still really unpleasant. There's always a lot of potholes. Like, they just repaved it. Yeah. There's still a lot of issues with crossing it, but it's not, I don't think it's at the risk of, you know, immediate closure for that reason, but you never know.
You never know. And so if the lateral slide method, and this is not a new dance craze, if that is chosen, what kind of approvals would be needed to go ahead with this?
Yeah, so there are always, you know, state and federal permits. I don't know about local permits. Probably there's some right-of-way acquisition or easements, rather, that would need to be maintained. But there, the land on either side of the bridge is primarily owned public land, so there that risk of that holding up the bridge is lower than perhaps other projects. And then, you know, with all federal transportation projects, there's a lengthy environmental review that comes next. And you never know what they'll find there. Hopefully everyone, you know, kind of keeps to the timeline because they could lose some money.
Yeah. I think there is a fish ladder on one side, but I think the lateral slide would be, you know, ideas the other side of the bridge. Are there any other options that V-Trans is considering other than the lateral slide?
Yeah, they are, you know, I think anything's on the table. They just have the traffic impact, you know, at the forefront of their mind. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they've looked at the method that is being used in with the drawbridge in Grand between Grand Isle and North Hero.
Oh, right.
Where... Yeah, that project I think is almost done, where it's similar, where you would build a temporary bridge next to the old one, and then they replace the old one, you know, over time, but keep that temporary bridge. I think that's an expensive option to build an entirely new temporary bridge to just take it down. In that sense, they're building two bridges instead of one.
Yeah.
So it's all within the grant, the constraints of the grant, I think. But according to V-Trans, they are considering options, but the lateral slide is definitely their preference.
Now, Courtney, when you were mentioning the money, I think each city, Burlington and Winooski, have to kick in $1.5 million each. Are they cool with that?
I think that they've known, you know, both cities want this bridge to be replaced. They know that it's not great for anyone going over it. I think that they just weren't necessarily anticipating winning this grant. Like, it was a nice surprise, but all of a sudden they have this grant match that they have to come up with. Burlington, Murrow Weinberger, the mayor, has said he's confident, he's not too worried, but at the same time, long-term borrowing may be off the table for Burlington. As probably your listeners know, there's a large school bond coming up in Burlington, which will essentially max out the district's and the city's shared capacity. So the city is really feeling constrained in its ability to take out a loan. Winooski was more concerned potentially. The mayor there, Mayor Lott, said that that's a large amount of money. You know, she thought that this project would be a little bit farther away, but she thinks that there are some options. Potentially they can take on more debt, unlike Burlington. They could maybe also leverage some coronavirus relief funds, she said. But they're going to start talking more, you know, getting into the details during this fall's budget season.
All right. Now, Courtney, I'm not sure, you know, if you're aware of this, but I'm going to paint this picture. You're coming from Burlington, you know, across the bridge, around the Winooski Speedway. You head up Main Street. And I think eventually, you know, you're heading to I-89. I think you're going to run
smack dab into that diamond crossover interchange thing, right? At I-89. And I don't know when that construction. How exciting for drivers will this all be?
You know, that's a factor I didn't consider, yeah. Rick. Perhaps I should have. But yes, that project too has the diverging diamond, is yeah. that what it's called? Has been on the table for some time as well. And I have to admit, I don't know the timeline for that. But, you know, the worst case scenario would probably be that those projects are happening concurrently.
That'll be so great. I can't wait to have you back on and talk all about that one. You can read Courtney Landon's story in this week's issue of 7 Days or at 7daysvt.com. Courtney, it has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. Take care.
We're going to take a break for news, and then we're going to head to Molly Brook Farm. And tonight, Red Sox open a series against the Tampa Bay Rays at Fenway. Our coverage begins at 6:10, first pitch 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Back in December, I was starting the WDEV anniversary tour in Harry's Hardware in Cabot. And while I was warm and cozy next to the paint aisle there, about 4 miles over Danville Hill Road, Rhonda and Miles Goodrich were working hard on their daily chores that keep the Molly Brook Farm running smoothly. Their hard work was recently rewarded by UVM Extension as Molly Brook was chosen as this year's Vermont Dairy Farm of the Year. Joining me now to discuss the farm and the award are the Goodriches, Rhonda and Miles. Congratulations. Welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much for having us on your show to talk about our dairy farm.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Listeners, if you'd like to ask our guests about Molly Brook Farm, or if you'd like to thank them for their hard work, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, Miles, can you give us a history of the Molly Brook Farm?
Sure. Yeah, good morning, Rick.
Morning.
The farm was started in 1835. And it was started up on top of the mountain, about a half a mile from us now, and they moved down into the valley here, which is still pretty hillside, about 15 years later. Hmm. And then it's been here ever since. And my grandfather had sold the herd in 1917 and bought all registered jerseys. And the cows that we have now are descendants of those.
Wow. Over 100 years of that Jersey lineage. Miles, when did you and Rhonda take over the Molly Brook Farm?
We bought it in 2013, bought out my parents.
Mm-hmm. And Rhonda, how about a little tour of the farm today?
Well, right now, if you were here, you'd see cows, our milking cows grazing up on top of the hill, and you can see them from Route 2. Inside the barn, we've got a little calf named Foolish, who is just a crazy little thing. The barn is pretty empty this time of year because we rotationally graze a little over 100 acres, which for us, one of the reasons that we rotationally graze is the animals are getting their own feed, and we're not fertilizing those acres anymore. So if you think about it, a diesel tractor isn't going over each of those miles three or four times a haying season.
Wow, that's incredible. How many are you milking these days?
We're milking 72 milking cows, but of course we have young stock heifers. Yep. And some cows that are taking a little 2-month vacation mm-hmm. before they calf back in.
Gotcha. And Rhonda, where do you ship your milk?
Oh, we ship our milk to Stonyfield. We transitioned to organic and shipped our first organic load of milk to Stonyfield in 2018. Oh, excuse me. Yes, 2018.
Yeah. Well, I got this wonderful note from Charlie Taplin down in Brookfield, and he said, I first met Walt and Sally Goodrich in 1967 when I bought a bull calf and then over a period of years bought more that helped build up the herd of Jerseys at the Percy Farm in Stowe. In 1992, I started Brookfield Agricultural Services, and most of my customers were organic. I did work with conventional dairy, and one was Molly Brook Farm, and now Miles was a partner. I retired but knew they were going organic. He said this is a well-deserved award to a family that he's known for years. So congratulations from Charlie Taplin to the two of you. Miles, those jerseys are just beautiful to see in the fields, but what makes them so special for milking?
Well, they're more efficient transitioning the feed to milk. The milk is higher in fat and protein, and they're just fun to work with. They're kind of naughty sometimes. They try to get away with stuff, so it keeps it interesting.
Yeah, I have heard people who have jerseys always talk about their personalities, and they really love having jerseys on their farm. Now, who, pray tell, was Molly Brook Fascinator Flower?
She was a cow that was supposed to go to the Jersey State Sale when she was about a year and a half old. But all of a sudden, this was in 1979, I believe. She was supposed to go to the state sale, and she had one quarter of her udder that swelled up a little bit. So we kept her out of the sale, and everything came from that. She had her first calf, and my mother recognized something special about her, and she has 39 bulls in AI service. One of them was the top number one bull in Australia.
Wow.
And she had, I don't know just how many here that were some of the top bulls. And her daughters also transmitted, you know, great genes to the offspring. So she's just one of those extraordinary cows. She was voted the third best jersey in the world.
Wow, she took the bronze. That's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And Rhonda, because of the richness of the milk of jerseys, what does Stonyfield use your milk for?
They use our milk to make yogurt. In New Hampshire. And, of course, Jersey milk would be wonderful for yogurt.
Right. Makes total sense. Do you have any favorites in the herd?
We do have some that really, really are super fun to work with. And, of course, each of our cows has its own name and personality, and some of them have nicknames. I really am enjoying Shadow right now. I mean, she's a beautiful cow with a beautiful udder, and, you know, she's really producing high, but she's just so pleasant to work with. You know, she always comes in and stands right up there and just does what she needs to do.
And don't you have one called Pretty as well?
Oh, we do. Oh, I love Pretty, too. Yes. And she is really pretty. Yeah. And sometimes we name them, you know, like we had one that we named Fun, who was not fun. So, you know, when they're calved and you're naming them, you don't know just how they're gonna develop.
The rest of the herd keeps thinking, why do they call that one Fun?
Right. She's no fun.
Yeah. Thinking, oh, the irony, oh, these guys. Miles, why and when did you transition to organic?
Well, we started thinking about it. I was thinking about it 10 years before we bought the farm, but my parents didn't want to they had been used to conventional, and they didn't want to change. So because of the genetics that they had worked so hard to, bring about. Mm-hmm. And we just saw the world changing a little bit, decided we would like to go organic. So when we bought the farm in 2013, we decided that was the route we wanted to go. So we started the transition in 2015, and we shipped our first load of milk in 2018.
Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, you could use the same herd, right? It takes a number of years of changing your practices, what you're feeding them, et cetera. Am I right about that?
Yes. Yes. The land took 3 years to transition where we were growing corn before because of the herbicides in the soil. And the cows were 1 year of feeding completely organic feed.
And this is a massive change, you know, for an operation, like you said, that dates back to the 1800s. Has it turned out to be a good decision for the Molly Brook farm?
It is for us, yes. We were trying to do everything as much organically as we could before we transitioned. So as far as the cows go, it wasn't a big change, but to stop growing corn and just feed haylage and grain, it's quite a big change.
Yeah. Rhonda, Miles is seventh generation on the farm. How deep are your farm roots?
I just go back probably fourth generation. However, back then, back in Vermont, people had to have cows and animals to kind of survive, really.
Mm-hmm.
But just, I'm fourth generation.
You're a newbie, Rhonda.
Exactly.
and the eighth and ninth generation, do they have an interest in keeping Molly Brook going on and on?
The ninth generation does.
Yeah.
Our grandkids, they love to come down and work, and they really know a lot about the farm, too.
Oh, how great. Miles, we hear a lot about the challenges and the struggles of Vermont dairy farms and have had to report, on the selling of the herd, far too many times. What have been the most difficult aspects of keeping Molly Brook Farm viable and operating?
Trying to keep expenses under control. There's not a lot of profit to be made, so we prioritize every financial, event that comes up. We decide what's most important and try to figure a way to be able to afford it. We just be very cautious.
Yeah. What is it that, and I'm assuming you do, is it still something you enjoy doing?
Most of the time. There's days where I, could think of most anything else I'd rather be doing, but probably 90% of the time I enjoy it a lot.
That's not too bad a percentage for most people in the workforce.
Right.
So. Your job satisfaction is fairly high. Rhonda, as I mentioned, the farm was recently named 2022 Vermont Dairy Farm of the Year. What does that award mean to you and to the family?
Well, it's not something we had planned, but it's very much appreciated. We try to do a good job, and we work hard every day, and we were very surprised. My parents and I won the same award in 1987.
Yep.
So it wasn't completely new to us, but it's been, 35 years. So it's nice to be recognized.
Yeah. Rhonda, how is the winner chosen? What do you know about what criteria is used?
Well, I know that they take a look at your farm. They look at, how your operation runs, if it's financially sound. They look at your community, activities. I think those are maybe the big ones. I'm not speaking really well, to that because I still am not entirely sure why we won. There are so many great farms in this state, and there are farmers that work so hard that, you know, we just feel, you know, maybe not as deserving, really.
Yeah, it is humbling, I would imagine.
It really is.
Yeah. When you heard the news, did the girls get something extra in their feed, or did they do a victory lap, or you know, around the grounds?
They get something extra every day. They get treated better than we do.
Yeah, they do. Although they do like the attention. I will say that if we have visitors that stop, and we certainly welcome visitors, the cows are always very interested in new people.
Oh, interesting. Because I'm not sure all cows are like that. A lot of times they kind of, I don't know, have more of an apathetic feeling towards outside humans.
Know who's here and what's going on. And if you're doing a job where they're around, they'll all stop and watch you. Like, you'll have 72, 75 cows watching everything you're doing.
You got a lot of bosses, Rhonda.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, Miles, one of the things that you mentioned on your website is that you value rural farm life. And we hear so much about the challenges of rural communities and economies. What is it that you cherish so much about this lifestyle?
Well, we're our own boss, which is kind of hard because we're harder on ourselves than any other boss would be. We strive to do the best job we can every day, and if there's any place we can make improvements, we do that. We try to keep, you know, like our part of the community clean and, you know, water flowing in the right directions and, you know, help out where we can.
Let's take a call from Henry, who's joining us from Moortown. Hi, Henry. Go right ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to say congratulations to you folks. Farming is very hard, you know, like 8 days a week. I don't know.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for you folks having your green pastures and everything in your, you know, farms all kept up, I mean, it wouldn't be Vermont. You're holding it together for us, and I really want to say thank you.
Oh, Henry, beautiful sentiment. 8 days a week, 13 months a year.
There you go.
I remember stopping in at Robillard Flats one time and interviewing the folks there. And when they told me, I'm a city boy, when they told me what it is like to be a dairy farmer, I was stunned. And, you know, there's this question of why would you even bother? Rhonda, this is a staggering thought. As I was reviewing, you know, your website and prepping for today, I realized that virtually every day for nearly 200 years, some good, rich family member has been on the job, working that farm. And that's a serious commitment. So, what keeps you all so dedicated to this farm and those cows and that work?
Well, I think one thing is that the Goodrich family, they're resilient. I mean, they're willing to make the changes that need to be made to keep the farm going. They're willing to work hard and put the time in. And dairy farming is very hard, but also, I mean, working with these cows and seeing the funny things that they do and being out on the land, it's beautiful. Like this morning when I brought the cows up to pasture up on top of the hill, the fog was still in the valley, and I was just thinking, this is just beautiful. Why don't I ever have a camera with me to take a picture that I can post on Facebook or Instagram?
You've got to start doing that, Rhonda.
Yeah. I mean, there is a lot more to it, and there is a lot of hard work. But there's a lot of fun. I mean, working next to your husband, you know, and us working as a team, and really, when we're milking together, it's kind of like we're doing a dance in the parlor because we're both moving fast and we're doing this and that and just working around each other just really, really well.
Yeah. Henry's still on the line, wants to make one more point, so let's go back to Moortown. Henry, go right ahead.
Yeah, sorry I got cut off. I don't know. I just it's such a big part from one end of the state to the other. We get up to the Northeast Kingdom, especially in the fall, when we have all the colors and everything, and people from all over are appreciating what's going on out there. My son and his wife put up a greenhouse this year. I mean, it's just kind of trivial to farming, but to see the time and the energy that goes into these programs, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
And it's good to see that the state also does help out the farmers and the little guys at home.
Yeah. Thanks, Henry. We're almost out of time. I want to get one more call in very quickly. And who do we have coming up? We have Lawrence. Lawrence, go right ahead. Make it quick.
Yes. I just wanted to say Connie and I were visiting in Maine 15 years ago, and the people at the bed and breakfast, and they heard we were from Marshfield. They said, oh, yeah, we drive on Route 2 there, and that beautiful farm that we look down on. And so they were talking about that farm in Maine, you know. Such a beautiful spot.
Yeah. Oh, Lawrence, thanks so much for sharing that. Rhonda and Miles Goodrich, thank you so much for taking time out of the incredible workload you have. Rhonda and Miles Goodrich own Molly Brook Farm in Cabot. You can learn more at mollybrookfarm.com. I want to thank you both for being on. And again, congratulations, a well-deserved honor to the two of you.
Well, thank you, Rick.
You're welcome. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Monday when we meet Dino Man Bob Lasias, artist Jim Sardonis, and we learn about WDEV's digital services.